This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about sobriety with one of my favorite people, and certainly one of my favorite drag queens, Mrs. Kasha Davis, who I had the delight of getting to interview previously on Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast, where we had a very funny, but also surprisingly like wholesome, life-affirming chat. And this one also carried a similar theme where there was so much of this conversation that was both incredibly spot on about sobriety in a way that I think will really apply to anyone that's on that journey or considering changing their relationship with alcohol or anything else they might want to become sober from, but also very moving and specific about this individual story as well. And so I don't want to delay for a second. Let's get straight into this conversation. And if, like me, you're a Drag Race fan and you're wondering who I will be rooting for in the next All-Stars season, I think this episode also answers that question, as well as any you might have about the actual theme we're here to talk about today. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi there, it's me, Mrs. Kasha Davis, a.k.a. Ed Popel, and I'm delighted to be here today to share with you some stories of the past and the present and of my experience with regard to mental illness and recognizing some of those things that have occurred in my life. I first, when asked the question about a story or an experience, I go back to when I was, oh gosh, in my 20s, which was a while ago, and I think about when I was coming out. And I think about the imposed negativity and torture I was experiencing because of the fact that I was in the closet and I was married to a beautiful woman, a friend of mine who I met in high school. And we were together from 1988 to 1998. And for obvious reasons, we were on the path of divorce. And I grew up in a household where I was punished for being feminine in any way. And so that negative self-talk was something that just started early on in my life. And then I thought I kind of won over my parents, specifically my father, by getting married. And the day that I married, I remember the best man, who is a friend of mine who is also out and proud and was at the time, was like, you know, Eddie, you're gay, aren't you? And I said, yes, but what am I going to do about it now? And so I cried the whole day at our wedding because I loved her so much, but also because I knew that a part of me had died. And so I felt tortured and this negative self-talk. And I lived in a town in Scranton, Pennsylvania. There were no openly gay people. And so all I knew in the 80s is that if you were gay, you would end up with AIDS and die, period. And so there were no examples of people living this happy, healthy life. So this story then goes into, it was time for me to come out. It was time for her to live her truth and be happy with a man who was 100% authentically interested in her, both physically and emotionally. And it was time for me to live my truth and be free. And so upon the divorce afterwards, it was this crash and burn of depression and of manic episodes because of that negative self-talk and of the fact that I really didn't know how I would move on in life. And I remember sitting at one point in a rocking chair when I had to move back into my parents' house before they disowned me for coming out. And I remember looking, it felt like I was looking down this long, long, long hallway to the light. I was way back in the dark. And that's how depression felt to me. I was in a long hallway alone. And my youngest little sister came up and kind of gave me a hug and was like, come on, let's go for a walk. And she had come out to me. And I felt this like first moment of, oh, I'm not alone. And that was the beginning of some positivity, but I alluded to being disowned. And my solution to this depression and this anxiety that I was feeling was to drink alcohol. And that would take away a lot of that negative self-talk and anxiety temporarily until it came back again on full force later.
That's so much to take on at that point in your life. And I think even listening to it, I can feel that, and I'm sure the listeners can too. And therefore, I can see how drinking felt like an option, even if you didn't consciously choose it, to numb that stuff out that you had so much to process.
And there were no, at the time and in the circle that I was in, there were no examples of people living this happy, healthy life being out. Mm-hmm. I even danced in a ballet company, and the people that were gay were in the closet or just never talked about it. So I didn't see this example of a life until I eventually moved to Rochester. And so there were these cycles of times and moments in my life that the solution was always to anesthetize with alcohol for anxiety, for depression, and then to lift myself up. And it worked on a temporary basis. It would work for a period of time, whether it was hours or days. And then it seems whatever anxiety or depression I was experiencing would be put on the back burner for a period of time. And then when it would come back, it would be multiplied with whatever the next thing I was going through. Mm-hmm. And so I never really ended up dealing with things. I just kept pushing it back. And then it would require more alcohol to anesthetize. And I did begin to seek counseling, and I was put on anti-anxiety medication on a daily basis, which was helpful. And then in those periods when I would go seek counseling and be on these meds, it seems like I would drink less, but then it would creep back because of whatever. It became my tool and the solution that I used for coping.
Yeah. It became your kind of go-to. And I think there can be such a routine to it that people underestimate. You know, there can be potentially that addiction side, but then also the routine of it, that you get to a certain point in the day and you drink. Or when you have free time, you drink. Or when you're social, you drink. And I think when so much of this is normalized across cultures as well, you know, it's the case here, it's the case in the States, then there's a lot of this behavior that becomes routine for everyone around you and maybe gets normalized to an extent.
Absolutely. And it is something that is ingrained in culture to celebrate, is ingrained in culture to relax. It is ingrained in our cultures to, when times are bad, oh my gosh, I'm so frustrated, I should have a drink. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that that doesn't work for some people, because some people can have a drink. For somebody like myself, one drink leads to another. And when we talk about mental illness, it is considered that addiction, alcoholism, drug abuse, that these are, it can be classified as a mental illness in that the phenomenon of craving begins. So that it is that my body, once I have one, I need 12. And I don't want to just have a drink to enjoy the taste. I want to have a drink to pass out. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, that is a slow form of suicide. Maybe not obviously, but I have learned in my recovery process that it is a slow form of suicide. And so I've also learned such phrases as, you know, questioning.
And I want to pause on that, actually, your experience of it and feeling it's a slow form of suicide. To clarify on that, do you mean that for you, it was a way of kind of like self-obliteration ultimately, that you saw that maybe that was either the goal or that was what you were, or maybe a byproduct of how bad the drinking was, that you were heading towards that point?
That's a good question. I think what I was alluding to mostly is that when you want to drink to specifically pass out versus enjoy the cocktail or enjoy the buzz, when you are doing it to put yourself to sleep, it is a dangerous slope. It was for me. Mm-hmm. So that here I mentioned I was on anti-anxiety medications, and then you add alcohol. If I'm drinking to the point where I want to pass out and just not feel, then really how close am I to essentially maybe not admitting it, but that I felt like I just wanted to die. Mm-hmm. And it took me some time to realize in therapy and in my recovery process of group counseling and AA and all of this to take a look and say, oh gosh, I really was not so much afraid of dying, I was more afraid of living. And so I would put myself out because I didn't want to experience. When I say afraid of living, the first thing you think of is living, it's joyous and free and happy. But I needed to live through some of this negative stuff. I needed to accept the fact that I had this experience and I made the choice to marry and stay in the closet in order to try to please other people. And I needed to realize that who I was not being honest with was not necessarily my parents, it was myself. And so the more I started to realize some of these things, the happier I became. But it took time, it took talk therapy, it took, yes, absolutely, times when I needed some medicine to help so that I can get out of the lowest points of the low depression and begin to do things that are good for me. As mentioned, the talk therapy, exercise, and finding that community of people. I didn't realize there was this community of people that were out, first and foremost. And then years later, when I sobered up, I realized, oh my gosh, there are a lot of people in the world that are sober too. Or there are people that don't, or that just simply just don't drink, and they can still have a happy, healthy, productive life. And I don't have to do what everybody else is doing.
Yeah. No, this is it. And I'm one of those people. And sometimes I don't talk about it unless I kind of need to. And I think, again, that is some of the normalization, that it's assumed you drink unless you say otherwise. And so sometimes I don't want to have the conversation, and I don't enjoy that there is this expectation, even if it's not kind of overt and pointed, that I have to have a reason.
Right. Or I need to explain myself. Or can't you just have one? Or really explain, you know, what is that like? And usually, first of all, it's nobody's business. And there are often times where you just don't want that attention. You're just not looking for the attention in that matter. I mean, as a drag queen, you know, I'm obviously looking for attention. But maybe not so much when I was initially in that situation of not drinking. Now, I could throw it into a joke, or I certainly make it pretty obvious with regard to my catchphrases and different things that I say. I'm very open about my sobriety. Why? Two things. One, because it helps me to remind myself that to be as honest and open as in life. And what does that do? I'm hoping, as I referred to earlier, that I didn't see people living out and loud and proud as in their heart, authentic self as a homosexual for me specifically, but then also living out and loud and proud as a sober person. And so to be that living example of somebody who's working through it, sure, there's potential that I could stumble. But if I remain consistent with the things that I've learned one day at a time, chances are I'm going to be good for at least today.
Mm-hmm. I like that. And I want to trace back a little bit to some of the earlier experiences you shared there. So in terms of when you got married and you had that conversation with your best man, was your sexuality something you had openly discussed with him at that point? Or was it something that he suspected and you'd maybe never denied?
You know, we grew up together and we would allude to things. We would go on family vacations together and we would go to the beach, and at the beach there would be the magazine shop, and we'd both go to the magazine shop and we'd be looking at the, you know, the nudie magazines of the boys, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we'd catch it and we joked about it, but we never were really that open about it until that evening. And it was almost like, oh my gosh, this is almost too late. And, well, it didn't have to be too late, but I thought that, oh God, I could never do this. I can't cancel this event. Everybody's come here for this and we've spent so much money. And I had come out to my wife in dating and then once before we got married, and her response was, oh goodness, you're just very European. We'll deal with it.
Yeah, I didn't know it was a Europe thing.
I know, right? So God bless her. So she was learning Spanish and traveling to Spain and going to school back and forth. And to her, she was like, oh, it's just open-mindedness and being free with your sexuality. And maybe, I don't know, because we divorced and really never had the chance to communicate. And God bless her, she's passed away now since. Maybe there was an acceptance and or a interest in her feelings about me maybe being bisexual at the time. I'm not sure. We were so young and naive, we never really got to those conversations. But that may have been the case, and that maybe that would have been something that we could have explored. But at the time, I was so adamant, and she was so adamant about we need to separate. I mean, we got married at the ages of 20 and 21. Mm. So it was clearly the mindset of, for me, the first girl that would say yes. And if I do this, my family will love me. And that makes me sad to even verbalize that, but that's how I felt. And what a terrible reason to get married. I know now that we were friends and that we were close and that we did have a love for one another and that friendship is extremely important in a marriage, but more importantly, it's about being honest and being truthful and being whole and, you know, sharing your whole self with someone.
Yeah. And it sounds like to an extent that went in both directions as well, that maybe, you know, she had her own reasons for being in denial about your sexuality.
Possibly. We cared so much for each other. We essentially grew up together. You figure if it was 88 to 98, we met, 88 would have been our junior year in high school, grade 11 here. So we were children, you know? So we were growing up together and we cared about each other and we were supporting one another. And she obviously knew the relationship I had with my father that was tumultuous and difficult and verbally abusive and at times physically, because I know now that the majority of that was for him trying to scare me into the closet because he thought he was fearful for my life. And that was the only way he knew how to handle it.
Was to possibly become the biggest threat to your life, ironically.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's far from the only time it's happened. You know, I've heard right. many stories like that. And for you, when did the drinking start generally? And was that something that you were around in the household?
So my father was a drinker. My mother was not. My father drank. And when he did, he got meaner. He was always mean, but he got more verbal. And he and I would go nose to nose at that point. And so being a outspoken youth, I would get into fights and we'd get verbal or physical and it would never end well. So I didn't drink in high school. I remember in college, my ex-wife and I were graduating from the same college together and my dad said, do a shot. I didn't want to do a shot. He said, do a shot. I did the shot and the anxiety and the anger I felt for him went away. And I was like, oh, I remember that moment vividly. I remember thinking that felt too good to be true. That's literally what I thought. And so fast forward, we drank, we got tipsy, things would happen. But the day that our divorce was in the paper, I remember I was on medicine for anti-anxiety. I was drinking heavily. I think I drank a bottle of Tanqueray and I was out and about and I was so embarrassed. My family was so embarrassed that the divorce was in the paper and I got my first DUI. And my father was a U.S. Marshal and got me out of it. Lighter sentence kind of a thing. And so that was the beginning of that binge, excessive to tune out drinking. So that was my first experience with drinking and driving. And it seemed as though I had this idea that once I got in the car, it was sort of like, no one can see. No one knows. I can keep the car. I have this control. I'm powerful. I drive with one eye open. What the heck was I thinking? I wasn't thinking. Obviously, it takes away your ability to think clearly. Mm-hmm. And so fast forward, I'll tell you this series of the alcohol abuse. Fast forward to coming out, being disowned, my father spitting in my face, telling me to go, to never come back again, my mother being dramatic. And I flee back to where I had moved, which is Rochester, New York. So you figure it's about 4 hours away from my hometown, up near Canada, essentially. So I moved to this city where people like Gary and Lake, Ambrosia Salad, Pandora Box were performing. And I was finding a community, but it was all in the bars. And every day I would work my job. And then at night, it was which bar did we go to? You know, there was the Wednesday night bar, the Thursday, the Friday, Saturday, the Sunday afternoon, the Sunday evening. And then maybe we would take Monday off, but there was a place that had a special on a Monday too. And so it was, yes, I was finding this community. I had been disowned. I found this community, but it was all revolving around drinking. And we had similar stories. I had friends who were also estranged from their families and we bonded and we created family. We would have times of holiday dinners together because nobody else would have us. And it was beautiful and it was joyful. And I learned so much about myself and other people in that time. And one of my best friends who also was disowned by his parents, he ends up in an accident that almost killed him. And a few weeks later, we did a benefit for him and I got another DUI. So it's my second time being arrested for drunk driving. And I wasn't as bad as I've been before. I wasn't that bad. Anybody would have drank that much because of what happened to my brother. Excuses, excuses, excuses. And I would manage it and get it in better control. And there would be times when it would be okay. And if something would occur that was excessively emotional, like my mother, who had passed away early in her life and at the age of 64, excessive drinking again, to get closer to her, to feel her, and being passing out in the living room floor, waking up, horrible situations, and then getting it back under control again. So I think getting cast on RuPaul's Drag Race season 7, coming home from some touring, and suddenly there's no work. So what's my solution? Crash and burn. I've left my daytime job, my career, to become a full-time artist. And guess who's drinking excessively again to deal with this and to tune out? And after a series of gigs out of town, I end up getting my final and third DUI at noon, swerving from children in my neighborhood. And so that following morning, when my husband, Steve, explained this to me, I dropped to my knees and asked whatever there was in the world, whatever there was in the universe, however you want to define it, for help. And I began the process of recovery. And that was now almost 8 years ago. And I sought out the counseling of a outpatient rehab program where you go in for hours upon hours. I lost my license for 4 years. And I began the process of recovery with regard to the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned how to live. And I learned that I was powerless over that substance. And I learned the word gratitude. And my life began to change slowly but surely, moment by moment, hour by hour. I began to realize how to live and to live freely without drugs or alcohol.
And that's so great to hear. And something I often see people talk about when it comes to sobriety is these moments of acceptance, that it can often take many times of accepting to different levels how bad things are for you. And what were the beats like for you? Did it take that third DUI and losing your license, or were there times earlier when you did confront this stuff, even temporarily?
I used to think that I can control it. I used to think, oh, well, I don't need to drink gin more. If I don't drink until 5, if I make sure I eat first, if I don't drink when I'm sad, good luck with that. You know, for me at least. If I, you know, so I would have all these different things. Or if I don't drink, oh, you know what? If I could stop drinking for a month, what do they call it? Like no drink January or whatever, when people, people put themselves through these dry spells.
Dry January, yeah.
Oh, yeah, dry January. So all of a sudden, for me, I'm either, at the time, I was either always drunk, hungover, or thinking about drinking. So to me, that's always drinking. Your mind is occupied, it's obsessed. And so what I had learned with regard to acceptance is that I was powerless over that substance. It would trigger something and change something where I had the phenomenon of craving where I could not stop. It didn't matter. There was no human power that was going to stop that. Until I found this community of people that understood and that we could talk to each other and realize that, yes, sometimes it would be triggered by boredom, stress, happiness, every emotion that there is. But if you got together with other people who understand this, you begin to go on this process of recovery. And that is tough, to admit power. Nobody wants to admit defeat. I don't care if you are, you know, however you identify in this world, on this planet, nobody wants to say, I'm powerless. But by admitting you're powerless over something, you actually find strength beyond belief. And that is what's so fascinating to me, is that, oh, I'm not a failure because I choose not to or can't drink. I'm a success because I'm identifying that that just doesn't work for my body chemistry, my mental status, spiritually, whatever it is, physically, mentally, spiritually. For me, alcohol changes this in a very dramatic way, that it's just not right for me. And I like to say that over and over, because I'm not here to say that if somebody drinks, that that's wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just, for me, it was. And that it began to be something that would go to such an excess that I would lose my mental faculties, my physical faculties, and that I make judgments like driving a vehicle, which would not only be dangerous to myself, but God forbid, dangerous where I could hurt and or kill someone else. And so when did it click? It clicked for me the morning when I woke up and my husband told me something that I didn't know. I didn't know that I stopped one more time at a liquor store for more alcohol. And I did not know that I swerved from children. And gratefully, that was written on the police report because I was able to read that and say, I'm not him. That's not me. That person that was driving that car that almost did that, that's not me. And that's not who I want to be. That is alcohol. Now, am I responsible for that? Those actions? The alcohol, yes, influenced those decisions, but I'm accountable. I'm accountable for it. And I needed to pay that price. And so I welcomed the time without my license. I welcomed the time where I would walk to the store. I had to wait for my husband to come home. And I think about those times. And sometimes I can cry about it because it was hard. But I needed it to be hard. I needed to realize you made a major mistake and will continue to make this mistake if you don't wake up and realize that that substance cannot enter your body. Mm-hmm. It was life or death.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's an interesting contrast to me with what you said about power. So there's that accepting for yourself, this isn't something that I have power over. Once I've had that first drink, you know, all bets are off. But also interestingly, there's the other side of that where you do have power to not be that person and not have that first drink in the first place, right?
Right.
And that's some of the really difficult work where I think sometimes part of the trap of alcoholism is this allure of, I'm not in charge of this. This is something that happens to me. And some of that can be the normalization we're around. Some of it can be meeting like-minded people, working in a space where you're around drink all the time. There's a lot there that I could see contributing to that denial, you know, enabling certain behaviors. And so it's also really difficult to admit there is something I can do about this.
And I didn't know what I didn't know. And what I mean by that is my tools pre-sobriety were to drink, to complain, to compare, and to use these negative words like I can't or this is happening to me, etc. And when I began the recovery process, what is it that you learn in this process, whether it's counseling or if you go to a fellowship program, etc.? You learn things. Now, for me, what are those things? Well, sometimes it's as simple as the word pause. Pause before I speak. Do I do it all the time? No. Am I working on it? Is it getting better? Yes. Stopping myself. My favorite thing is when I am conscious in the morning, what I have done my entire life is to think, oh, loser. Or poking myself, gaining weight again. Negative self-talk. Is this from my parents? Maybe. It doesn't really matter. It's what I did. So now I wake and the first thing I think is going to be a wonderful day. It's going to be a blessed day. I'm grateful for today. I force myself to say those words. There are sometimes when I'm so tired, you know, when you're so tired that you wake up and you're still tired, then I'll go right to the negative. But I force myself. What are those words? What are those words? And they don't come quick. And I've been doing this for 8 years. They don't come quick, but they start. And then for me, I do meditation and prayer. And I'm a very spiritual person, more so than a specific religion. It is all right. All of it, as long as it's based in love, to me, it's all true. And so that's how I believe. And so there's time to spend quiet with the nature or read or do some readings. And I get in that space in the morning. And these types of mantras and meditation time and quiet time and understanding, you know what? I might be acting right now because I'm simply hungry. I'm tired. And instead of me making a decision or an action right now, I'm going to rest. And so recognizing these things and saying, this is my toolbox. These are also things that I can do. Now, in the past, a shot of alcohol or a pop of Xanax would take away the anxiety, right? Really quick. But these things that I'm talking about will also take away the anxiety, multiple deep breaths, meditation, calling another person who understands that might be somebody who's in sobriety, et cetera, meditation, prayer. These things also work, but they just take a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. And we are in this world. We all want everything right now.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to come that way. If we can be patient, and I will end this little soapbox of tools with the words we choose to use. My outlook on life has changed when I learned the use of the word grateful. Even in the worst of times, I can find something. If I can find something I'm grateful for, the universe will give me more of that. And that sounds kooky to some people, that universe giving you. But I believe that what you visualize, what you verbalize will materialize. And so if you continue to live in the, I'm negative, negative word, negative word, negative word, then that's your experience. And then on the flip side, it's not like putting your head in the sand and pretending like everything is terrific. But even in those difficult times, if you can find things to be grateful for, wow, my best friend was almost killed in an accident. But look at all of us here together. Look how much he's loved. We have one another. There's something to be grateful for. Of course, it's horrible that he's hurt. But we found the gratitude. And then when you find that gratitude, you can build upon it. And truly, it's life-saving.
Yeah, for sure. And I really believe in that. As for me, it's through the paradigm of cognitive dissonance, that we want to be right and that we want to see evidence of the things that we believe in. And so if we can find ways to focus on and, yeah, in your case, verbalize the things you're grateful for, then I think we do play a personal part in attracting more of that stuff. You know, for me, yes. I think it's very driven by us where, you know, if you think it's going to be a bad day, you can find an example of that real quickly if you want to. Yes. You know, if someone asks you, how's your day been? And you say, great. And they ask you, oh, how so? Then you'll find an example. And so I think a lot of it is what we focus on, we find evidence for. You know, we can want to continue that rightness.
I love that. And I remember, or I'm recognizing in the morning, I have a really close friend who texts me every morning, simple good morning, and just a connection. And I'll say back to her sometimes, I'll start to say, is it, or whatever, response that's negative. And here's an example of why I know I'm getting better. Before I do that, I'll go, nope. And I'll back it up and I'll think for a second about what is good. And it could be, yes, beautiful birds singing, you know, whatever. And then our conversation will continue. I will say that in terms of wonderful experiences where I know I am being guided in this positive direction, I was once with Darian Lake from RuPaul's Drag Race season 6 and now All-Stars 8. She and I were touring in Puerto Vallarta. Well, not touring. We had a show in Puerto Vallarta. And I'm newly sober and it's a vacation town. So everybody's partying, at least what I saw. And I thought, oh gosh, I need to find out because AA is all around the world. I need to find out if there's some meeting. And I don't know these streets and I don't know these street names aren't easy for me to pronounce. And oh my gosh, I started to spiral. So I was looking on the phone and I thought, let me go to the box office of the theater. Let me ask the theater manager, can you help me to make sure I'm on the right track to find this location? And he said, yeah, sure. It's in the basement of the theater. It's right downstairs. So the entire, I think, 2 weeks that we were there, I would stand on stage. And if I got nervous, if I didn't know my next song or, oh gosh, how's the audience responding? Or then if I thought everybody's drinking, I wish I was drinking, I would remind myself that in the foundation of this building is the program and are the people that are helping me to not just live, but to thrive. They're right below my feet. And it was one of the most powerful things that's happened in my sobriety where I was like, wow, like I'm being taken care of by this energy that is.
Yeah. Yeah. The help really is everywhere with this stuff in the way that I guess partly because of drinking culture, drinking is everywhere. And so, of course, help stopping has to also be everywhere. And so, no, I definitely see that. And we're talking today a few weeks out of you, at least from a viewer's perspective, going back into Drag Race, right? So you've already filmed a whole new season, All Stars 8. And right from your entrance line, it seems sobriety. I think the very first thing you say on the show this time references your sobriety. Do you mind sharing the line?
My entrance line is, my name is Mrs. Kasha Davis and I'm an alcoholic. Oops, wrong meeting. And when I knew that I was potentially going to be asked to compete, I knew right off the bat, I'm going to talk about this. Why? Well, when I left, I was not sober. And my catchphrase was, there's always time for a cocktail, which is still really fun. And a lot of people ask me to say it, and I'm happy to say it. And so it was important for me to, if coming back on All Stars is to show growth and to show growth in not just your drag persona, but you as a person. I thought right from the get-go, let me pick up where we left off. There's always time for a cocktail. And now my name is Mrs. Gasha Davis and I'm an alcoholic. And I will say that we're very early in, as was mentioned, we just announced. And so there's not lots to share. But what I can share with you is this, that entrance has been shared by the network, et cetera. And I'm receiving messages from all around the world, everywhere on my social media saying, thank you, I'm 25 days sober. Thank you, I'm considering sobriety. Thank you, I'm 10 years sober, whatever. And I knew that it was important to be open and honest. And now in talking about gratitude and talk about, oftentimes you don't know, sometimes we look at, what's the monetary payment for a job well done? To me, this is bigger than any monetary payment. To be able to say that here is a drag queen in not just the RuPaul's Drag Race network, but in general, that's out there that's living, breathing, and working soberly one day at a time.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think that's it, that you're being the example that you wanted to see, which is so great, I'm sure, is right up RuPaul's street. And right, it's his kind of shit. He loves therapy. And
yeah. Well, okay, yes. I'm gonna just leave it at that. I agree.
I'm also gonna leave it at that. And also, to be blunt about it, if you can be a drag queen and be sober, it's accessible to anyone. Your workplace is a bar. When we had our interview previously on my other podcast, you were talking about, part of the reason not just your audience loved you and your catchphrases, like there's always time for a cocktail, but also bar owners loved you, is because drinking was built into your act. It was something that you were helping pushing drinks because you are in an establishment where they're making a lot of their money off drinks. It's so intertwined there. And so if you And so I really think there is something to not be understated about that. No, I was just going to repeat myself. I was just going to say, if you can work in bars and be a drag queen and be sober, it's accessible to anyone.
It is. And it's hard to see that light at the end of the tunnel or whatever the catchphrase we want to use. When you're in it, it seems like it's the only thing that matters and you can't imagine because, let me say this, because I'm not a drug and alcohol counselor. I do know that anyone who is listening that is thinking of stopping should seek medical advice and make sure that they have the right people helping them, because there are sometimes in situations where it's not the right idea to just stop cold turkey. And so, because your body essentially won't let you. And that's an individual situation that would be a determination between yourself and your medical professional. But that being said, there are times when I'm glad I'm not booked for certain things. I couldn't imagine. I thought, oh, goodness. Well, yes, fine. I am getting work and sobriety, but I'm not going to get that gig, or I might not necessarily get this one. But what has opened up? Well, I'm working at colleges and I am teaching courses. I'm about to teach a course on Drag 101. And then I'm also about to teach where I'll do bingos, where we get together and we play bingo. And in between the games, we talk about these things that we're talking about today. And students are listening to these stories and are able to say, okay, there's an example of what happened with Mrs. Gasha Davis. But then also, I would never have thought that I would have gone down the line of Imagination Station, which is a children's television show that we're working to get placed on a streaming platform at this point. Never would I have ever thought. So when someone says, oh gosh, but if I stop drinking, will I have work? You have no idea how much work is out there for you. Again, if you are living your most authentic self, if you're being exactly who you are on the inside and you're living honestly, that work comes. It really, truly does. And you'll find yourself maybe speaking at a different engagement that certainly might have alcohol present, but it's not the main focus.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's so many other benefits to that. You're more likely to turn up on time in the right mindset, not dreading going to the job that you want if you're not hungover or drunk.
Right.
There's also that. And, the last thing I want to pick up on there before we wrap up is, it may also be that people can have this fear of, will I still be fun if I stop drinking? And I feel like you're a great person to address that.
It's a process. You know, I have a couple other friends are performers, and that beginning stage of not drinking and going to the club and or the cabaret space or to do stand-up comedy or whatever it is, and you're like, how am I going to do this? And you think like, oh, well, maybe I need to get an energy drinking, or oh, maybe I need to. And honestly, there's a difference between people laughing at you and laughing with you. And I know now that there were times when people were laughing at the drunken mess that I was on stage. And now I can, one of the things that I would reach for a drink for was if something like flubbed, right? I was thinking it was going to be this joke was going to land, or I was thinking that this song was going to really hit. Oh, it didn't go over well. Let me have a drink. And now if it's like in the midst of a comedy set and I'm like, well, this joke isn't landing. You just take a pause, take a breath and change direction. And then guess what? The potential, sometimes it's even funnier. Mm-hmm. And so you're dealing with things more in real time, and you're taking the time to plan more and rehearse more because you didn't have the time before because you were drinking too much. You know, you didn't rehearse. You didn't set out and plan your evening's outline of what you were going to talk about. And so you think that you're not going to be fun. And then guess what? Sometimes you just don't mix with certain people that you used to mix with before. When we say in sobriety, one of the things is sometimes you have to change people, places, and things. Well, if you no longer mix with a certain group of people, it's because probably because the thing that you had in common was being drunk, and you end up finding new, exciting, fun, and interesting people. And so that takes a level of bravery because it is like coming out again. It is a matter of, wow, am I always going to be this kind of steady? I think it takes some time. And the more that you give yourself that patience and be kind to yourself, you'll see that you can get yourself pretty excited about life and the gifts that come your way when you really are good to yourself and can honestly say that you are treating yourself with respect.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I love that. You're such a great speaker. No wonder you're invited into colleges. And, you know, I think all of this goes to illustrate the talent was always there. You were never funny because you had this many drinks before you went on stage. And it's great that you get to live that every day now. So,
well, thank you very much.
It's exciting. And I'm excited for this whole new phase as you embark back on Drag Race once more. And so as we wrap up then, what do you want to plug? So All Stars 8 coming out soon. People will be able to find it on Paramount, I think, in the US. See, I should have double-checked this before. And then I think WOW presents for most of the rest of the world.
Yes, and it starts streaming on May 12th, but there's the opportunity to follow my progress and things that are going by following socials. I'm on InstaSnatch, Twitter, and FacePlace, as I like to say, at Mrs. Kasha Davis. All things Mrs. Kasha Davis. So there are some things, other things that are hopeful things that are coming down the line. And then there are other things that will be announced that are with other projects that I'm excited about where you can really hear about it if you check in there.
Fun and mysterious. I love it. And you can also go find the iconic entrance line. So that's another reason to go follow you right now. And on that note, let's wrap up there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.